We have a few questions to start off with. And mind over matter, only over living matter? No. It's actually, there was, I've been saying this for a long time, that mind can interfere with physical stuff. Princeton University did this PEAR project, P-E-A-R, have a look at it on the internet. We're using mind to interfere with random events, physical events, and to see that it can skew the results away from what's expected by normal probability. Significantly so. So actually they were proving, PEAR experiments from Princeton University, that the mind can influence physical stuff. Just, and these aren't sort of great meditators, ordinary students asked to focus on something happening more to the left or more to the right, where it should be like a 50-50 with a standard deviation of probability, and it's much further than the standard deviation would expect. Many, 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 many times. So that's actually been proven. Now, how does it work in practice? I cannot avoid telling about one of my students who spent a year with me over in Perth. And after a year, I don't think he wanted to become a monk, just stay a year. And then he went back home to Germany to continue his studies at university. And I saw him afterwards, he came and visited as well, but he wrote this in a letter, it was a weird experience. The first day on the campus of his university, I think it was in Frankfurt, he walked past the ATM machine. And as he walked past the machine, he told me he heard a strange sound come out of the machine, which he described in really inaccurate language like a gurgling sound. And he interpreted that, he perceived that to be the ATM welcoming him onto the campus of the university. So from that time on, that ATM machine was his friend. And he'd always do his transactions at that machine, and he'd always talk to it nicely, and he'd always even like pat it or stroke it and give his metta meditation to that single ATM machine, his friend who welcomed him onto campus. And the result of giving loving kindness over many weeks and months to an ATM machine was he was having his lunch on a bench within sound, well, it's certainly within sound, within sight of this ATM machine. And he knew that no one had gone close to that machine for at least 15 or 20 minutes. He'd seen the machine. And then, for the second time, that ATM machine issued the same sound that it first uttered when he first came onto campus, a gurgling sound. And he looked in disbelief, because after that gurgling sound was finished, a 20 euro note came out from that machine. And he walked, no one had been close to it. He walked over, and he picked it up and waved it in the air and said, does this belong to anybody? Does this belong to anybody? And nobody claimed it, because it wasn't theirs. The ATM machine had given it to its friend. So his loving kindness has got 20 euros out of an ATM machine, and that is absolutely a true story. I interrogated him and said, look, you know, are you sure? He said, yes, honestly, I wouldn't lie to you. Many times, and you know, it was real. So yes, the mind can interfere with machines, and especially important machines like ATM. So if you carry on in the BSV, if you really get your meditation together, continue it, and you're out of cash one day, just go to the ATM machine, zap it with loving kindness. Oh, loving kindness machine, may you never run out of cash, may you never be robbed and pulled out of the wall by thieves, may you never run out of electricity. Oh, nice ATM machine, now cough up $20. That's true. There is, how that works, well, I can sort of know because you know the power of the mind, but yeah, the mind can interfere with material stuff. Oh, no, okay, the other stuff, I like this subject. A lot of times you can see that happening with hypnosis. Because in hypnosis, you're actually really harnessing the power of the mind. And there's a famous experiment. I remember reading about this when I was at university. The group of scientists hypnotized this man, and they just got a nail, a 4-inch nail, on an end of a piece of wood. And they, under hypnosis, they convinced this fellow that that nail was red hot. And they touched him on the arm with that red hot sort of nail, what he thought. It's just an ordinary nail at room temperature. It wouldn't burn anything. But of course, because he believed it was hot, he screamed in pain. Yeah, you can understand that. But what surprised them was a blister came up, a burn came up on his arm, a physical manifestation. And how did that happen? How could the mind actually create a burn on the skin? When, you know, that would need it like a high temperature to do that. So because he believed it was a burn, he created a burn. The power of the mind is quite immense. Anyway, here's a question. A meditation question. Oh, that's boring. I like these weird questions because they just open up new avenues of thought. In a deep and successful meditation, when I feel I have left my body and I feel unified with everything, it's so great I feel I want to stay. Immediately I have a fear that I may not be able to return. I'm immediately pulled back and left feeling very flat. What advice, techniques would you give to more move past this? It's great. What do you want to return for? You're having a great time. Come back to this. The husbands and going to work and washing dishes and going to toilets and crikey. So the next day, you feel it's great, you want to stay, and then you have the fear that you may not be able to return. It shouldn't be the fear, it should be the hope. Please, I don't want to return, I'm going to stay here. Stay there, enjoy it. Because whether you hope you stay or you fear you won't, you'll always come out of this. It's anicca, impermanent, it won't last, unfortunately. So you don't need to have the fear. So just stay there and just let nature take its course. You can stay there and enjoy your meditation. It is perfectly safe. And in fact, it's the best thing you could ever do for your health and for everything else. And even if you think that you're in danger of something, there's lots of great stories. And this one is from the sutras. There was a monk meditating in the forest. He got into such a deep meditation. He too was having the time of his life. Really peaceful, very, very still. It's just another car. A car? No, okay, you got a piece of paper there. Yeah, it's a car. Yes, it's a car! No, it's a question. Okay, boring. So, he was meditating in the forest. And really still, and two villagers came past who were looking for mushrooms or herbs in the forest. And they saw this venerable sitting perfectly still. So still that his chest wasn't moving at all. He wasn't breathing. They checked. He was dead. And so they thought, what can we do? We can't leave a Buddhist venerable in the forest to be eaten by the animals. We've got to do something with him, give him a proper cremation. So it was easy to do. They're in the forest, there's wood everywhere. So they collected a bit of wood, and that took them half an hour. But, you know, it's a nice thing to do. So they put the wood all together, they put the venerable on top, and then they lit the fire. You know, they had some chanting there too, you know. They don't know what chanting it was, they didn't really care, but it was something the best they could do in the circumstances. And once the fire was lit, they realized the fire would do the rest. They were busy people. They had to go collect the mushrooms or whatever. So off they went into the forest and left the fire to do the cremation. And they were really impressed the following morning when they saw that venerable walk into the village for arms round. Not even his robes were burnt. And that's in the sutras. It's a great little story. And it just shows you in that deep meditation, you are invulnerable. So if you do get in that meditation, don't be afraid. Oh my goodness, what would happen? You know, would the BS3 think, oh my goodness, she's dead, and take you to the crematorium and put you in one of those little gas ovens and fry you? Because what would happen if it's only meditation? As soon as the attendant, whoever it is who does all those burnings in the crematorium, as soon as they open the door afterwards of the ovens, there you are, say, hi, I'm still here. Now, the attendant might die, but you'll be fine. So you don't have anything to be afraid of. In meditation, you're the safest it possibly could be. So if ever you're, say, in MBM, you'd be Buddhist monastery, and if there is a bushfire, that's what you're supposed to do. Meditate, get in deep meditation, and the country fire service, whoever it is in Victoria, all the buildings will be gone, all the trees will be incinerated, but you'll be sitting there, still meditating, with your volunteer jacket still intact. That will be impressive, that will be cool. And when they see you, you'll be able to get plenty of donations to rebuild the place. Okay, that's the one. It's techniques to give you move past this. Realize you've got nothing to fear. Dear Ajahn Brahm, as the main care of our sick parent who had cancer, I have grown fear for cancer due to the stress, anxiety, and overwhelming emotion. I have a lot of tension and stress-related ache and pain. However, I scare myself by thinking it could be cancer. It's going to be me. Yeah. I do because the more I think the way, the more fear comes and causes tension. Vicious cycle. But often when I'm not awake, the anxiety, fear or cancer become too strong. What kind of meditation method would help with this? Okay, again, that's because you're thinking too much. So get into the body. So you do have some stress and just relax the body like I was saying this morning. 90% of the problems of human beings come from thinking too much. So if we could learn how to stop thinking, we'd be much healthier and much more sane human beings. So, you know, you've got a cancer, but your chances of getting cancer, have a look. Would you say like 1 in 9 women get sort of breast cancer? Does that make you scared? The answer is, not being scared, that 8 out of 9 women don't get breast cancer. The odds are in your favour. And also it's 10 out of 10 men don't get breast cancer. Always remember that, so I don't... And 10 out of 10 women don't get prostate cancer. So thank your lucky stars. This is called positive thinking, which is the opposite of worry. And it's incredible that, you know, after things like that, the bombing of the underground trains in London years ago, that's actually ridiculous. You know, afterwards people were afraid of going the underground trains because, you know, they could be bombed. Until someone pointed out, yeah, even if there was one bombing like that, one terrorist attack every year, it would still be safer to go in an underground train in London than go in a car. But are people afraid of going in cars? Of course not. Because we're just thinking really weird ways. So because of that, just first of all, get some nice meditation going. So your thinking just doesn't go in this really weird way. Which means that then all the emotion, the tension, the stress will disappear and you won't get the cancer anyway. People who meditate a lot, especially they meditate properly and get very peaceful. Oh, your immune system is going to be so strong, you're not going to get these things. Also, the mind is stubborn. I know I'm subject to aging, sickness and death, however, it is resisting this at the moment. Is this because I'm not peaceful enough to accept this? Again, yeah, you can say aging, sickness and death, but what comes before aging, sickness and death? Life. So procrastinate. Put off aging, sickness and death until tomorrow. Today, just meditate. Somebody showed me a Peanuts cartoon. You know the Peanuts cartoon? One of the reasons I love cartoons is because you get more wisdom in those cartoons than you get in philosophy books. And in this cartoon, you had Peanut, now Charlie Brown and his dog Snoopy. You know those two characters, Charlie Brown and Snoopy. And at the end of a pier and this beautiful sort of a lake, or it could have been a headland with mountains and ocean and beautiful sky. And Charlie Brown turns to his dog. I don't know why it is, but the dogs are always far wiser than human beings. Charlie Brown says, you know, Peanuts, you know that all of us one day will die. So true. All of us one day will die. As Snoopy said, all of us most days will not die. You see, that changes the whole perspective. And that's true. Most days of your life, you will not die. So why are you worried so much? Well, everything, one day I'm going to die. That makes you worried. So just change your perspective and then you'll be fine. So I love that little cartoon. I've done this one already. Ajahn Mum, I had a dream meeting with my late mum who passed away 4 years ago. Does it mean our spirits really meet each other? No, it just meant you had a dream. Because your late mum will probably be sort of reborn by now, or she hasn't been reborn in the heaven realm. However, if you have that dream night after night after night, many times, then there may be something. And especially if you're going through some problem, then it may be something. Because sometimes people do have these really weird dreams of people who died. There was this one Thai lady married to a Chinese man in Perth. And it's not a very good relationship. So that when she got very old and very sick and close to death, she came to see me and said, "You know, I don't trust my husband, George, the Chinese man. I don't trust him at all. He's so stupid that I don't think he can even arrange my funeral. So I've come to ask you, Ajahn Brahm, can your Buddhist temple arrange my funeral? And in return, you know, in my will, we'll give your temple 50% of my apartment." You know, which, you know, it's not a big apartment. It's only worth, I think, about $34,000 in the end. But still, that was a really good deal for our temple. But I can't make deals. Funerals cost about $5,000 or $6,000. This was going to get $30,000. So anyway, I had no right to accept that. So I gave it to our committee, and they had their meeting. You know what committees do? And they said, well, you know, why not? So a couple of months later, she died. Did the funeral for her. We paid for it. And we're Buddhists. We don't, as soon as the funeral is ended, okay, George, come and cough up. We're not like that. You know, we just waited for a reasonable time, like 2 days. No, we don't do that. It was about a month or something. We just asked him. Yeah. And you got the will. And he said, no, I can't find it. I can't find it. I said, okay, well, when it turns up, let us know. And a couple of weeks later, he came in a taxi to our monastery, which cost a lot of money, in a taxi. And he was really, really, wired and very, very, very anxious. So, what are you doing, George? So early in the morning in a taxi. He said, here it is. Here's the will. I've got the will for you. Here, take it. Take it now. Take it. Take it. So what happened? He said, well, you know, last night, middle of the night, I was fast asleep, and I dreamt of my wife. George, get the will. You know where the will is. George, get the will. He knew where the will was all the time. He just didn't want to give it to us. But he had the ghost come in the middle of the night to tell him, George, get the will. Give it to the monks. He was so scared. He couldn't give me that piece of paper fast enough. So his old wife, he thought he was free of her, that she was dead. No way. So be careful, guys. Just because your wife's passed away, she still's got your number. So if you have dreams like that, if it's just one dream, this is probably just you're thinking of her. But if it comes up often, well, if she says, daughter, 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 you haven't given that donation to the BSV. Oh, be careful. A few days before my dad passed away recently, someone saw my dad come into his friend's funeral with my late mum walking beside him. And a few days after that, my dad passed away because of a heart attack. Does it mean my late mum knows what would happen to my dad, so she was kind of visiting before he passed away? Could be. The only way you can find out is later on when you die. You can ask your mum and dad. There's an old story. I read this a long time ago. That, you know, in a house in England, you know, about 20, 30 years ago, And the father, you know, he had a nice little son, and in the house his mother-in-law was there as well. And he saw, his mother-in-law and father-in-law, grandparents, lived in the same house. And he saw his little sort of five-year-old son, you know, in the evening, past his bedroom. He was like praying, you know, the Christian, and said, God bless mummy, God bless daddy, God bless grandpa, and goodbye grandma. That's weird. God bless daddy, God bless mummy, God bless grandpa, and goodbye grandma. And he didn't think twice about it. But the following night, or that night, the grandma died. And, you know, they did the funeral service. Again, never thought much. And then, a few weeks later, passing by his little kid's bedroom and doing the doing the prayers again. God bless daddy, God bless mummy, goodbye grandpa. Blow me down that night, grandpa died as well. And you know, it was really, really spooky. And you can imagine what he felt a few weeks later when he went past his son's bedroom and his son was praying and says, God bless mummy, goodbye daddy. He was freaked out. So he couldn't go to sleep that night in case he would wake up dead. If he can't wake up dead, we know what I mean. If in the morning he was dead. So he sort of stayed up all night, you know, really trying to cheat death. And then he decided the best thing to do is to get out of the house about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, got his car, went to his office, locked the door, and waited. You know, the minutes went past so slowly. Was he going to survive, you know, the curse of his son? And as the sort of sun came up, he was still alive. He realized he beat the curse. He was alive. He was so relieved. But obviously really, really frazzled. So he finished his work and went back home early. And he just, you know, grabbed hold of his wife and gave her a big hug. Said, you wouldn't believe just what a difficult day I've had. You know, and before he could answer, he said, and you think you've had a difficult day? When I got up in the morning and opened the door, the milkman was dead. Please don't encourage me. Okay. So yeah, we'll find that later on. Do you believe in ghosts? Where is exactly ghost realms in the same world with human realms they could intersect? Oh wait, I told that ghost story last night. How many were here last night for the talk? Only one, two. Actually, no, did I? The ghost story about the Australian woman who went to the castle in England. I said it somewhere, where did I say it? It was here, yeah, previous day, okay. So I can't say that one again. But yeah, there are ghosts. They exist, and they are good fun. They are good fun. Ghosts have all these incredible powers. This nice ghost story. I think I wrote this one in the book. But anyway, nevertheless, this is a really nice ghost story. True one. Any of you who have been to our retreats in Perth, you know that the retreat manager is usually Bianca. And Bianca's husband, in the past, he died a few years ago, was called Ron. And years and years ago, he was a builder's labourer, at the bottom of the pile, but really hardworking. And he was renovating an old house in North Perth one week with his building company. And because he was the lowest, the labourer, when they'd finished on a Friday afternoon, he had to stay back to do the cleaning. So he was by this old house in the afternoon, alone, no one else around. And he was walking past the side of the house when he heard the sound. Put your hand under here. Put your hand under here. And he's straight away he thought he was imagining it, because there's no one around. But then he heard it again really clearly. Put your hand under here. So he did. He put his hand underneath the house. You know, just, you know, house on stumps, put it underneath there. And he felt a tin box. And he brought out that tin box, opened it up, and it was full of cash. About $15,000 or something. And that's the money he used as a deposit for his first house about 20, 30 years ago. How he got started. Because the previous owner, the reason they were renovating it, the previous owner had died. And he was one of these people who did not want to pay tax. So he hid all his money underneath the house. And then he died. And no, the money was there. You know, the dead guy couldn't use it. And he saw, you know, Ron, a really nice, good fellow, who was poor. And he wanted him to have it. So put your hand under here, Ron, so you can get my money. True story. If you see Bianca, you can ask her. So, don't be afraid of ghosts. If ever you're passing an old house in Melbourne, and you hear, put your hand under here. You must do that, but remember, because you heard this story here, 10% goes to the BSV. Commission. That's fair enough, isn't it? So ghosts can be actually very helpful sometimes, so don't be afraid of them. If you see one, you know, what you can do is, this is many times it's happened, I don't know how it works, but ghosts, one of the things they can do, they know the lottery numbers. They do. So if you see a ghost, say, lottery number first, and then run like hell. Get your numbers first. Anyway, okay, yeah, ghosts exist. They're good fun. Life would be so boring without ghosts. Here we go. Oops. Da-da-da. Most Venerable Ajahn Brahm, firstly, thank you very much for your teachings and making this priceless Dharma, including deeper teachings, available to lay people. I have the good fortune to listen to many of your Dharma talks. I understand the 7 enlightenment factors and 5 controlling faculties and 4 roads to success help in meditation. Do we have to practice both? Could you please explain? Oh my goodness. That is about a whole sort of year's talks in there. But, okay, 7 enlightenment factors. Just have to do it very brief. And again, the first one is, what is it? Sati, mindfulness. But again, mindfulness is a big word. It means like being aware, like I was saying earlier. But it's really what you're aware of. But once you are aware of something, then you can actually get to know it, the Dhammavicaya. And explore it. Just like I was saying with the being aware of feelings in your body. Then you can explore it and you can actually have some sort of control of it. And also, that gives you, especially if you know how to relax, that gives you some energy. Now, the energy is not something which you create, the virya. That's right, virya is the next. And that energy, people think it's like effort. It's not. It's the energy which comes up naturally from stillness. You get alive. Your batteries get recharged, so they're energized. So imagine batteries recharge, and once they're recharged, they're in full power. That's like your brain under full power because you've rested it. Mindfulness, just a little bit of exploration of how to restore your energy so you don't feel tired, you get wearier. And when your mind is energized, you always feel happy. A lot of times people get depressed. It's not some sort of sickness. Some of it is sicknesses, but some depressions are just tiredness. And not physical tiredness so much as emotional exhaustion. You've had problems in your life, difficulties, and you try to solve them, and you've exhausted all your mental energy, all your resources trying to solve problems, and because of that you've got no energy left. You're really low, burnt out. And that's just the case, your batteries are flat, and that's called depression. And it's not that hard, if you know how, to recharge your batteries by doing nothing. Just relaxing, resting, not worrying about anything, not fighting. And then your energies come back again. You can really get alive. And you feel that sort of energy, and that's so happy, that's so much joy when you get sort of higher with lots of real mental energy. And also, you get this wonderful tranquility, that's the next one, which comes, you know, when you are energized and mindful. You have this inner peace. You're not struggling for things anymore. You can relax. For you to get some tranquility in your body when you're meditating, you do need happiness, pity, joy. Sometimes people think they can get the body to be still and peaceful by force, by will. Doesn't work that way. You get some pity going up, some inspiration, some joy. It's so easy to sit still, and for your mind to be still too. And from that asadi, you get samadhi, stillness. Wow. Where nothing moves. And if you get to the place where nothing moves, the still forest lake, there you can understand the Dhamma, reflecting clearly in the lake without ripples. And that gives you the wisdom that afterwards nothing disturbs you. Life, death, misfortune, good luck, all of those things, they're just part of the world. So you're equanimous, even amidst the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, said Hamlet. He wasn't a Buddhist, so he didn't know how to deal with it. He just, okay, it will pass. You're equanimous. You never overreact or even react much at all. Seven enlightenment factors. In brief, five controlling faculties. Oh my goodness. No, that's enough for now. Because I've got lots more here. Dear Ajahn Brahm, you have explained that when the mind is stilled and empowered, things will look different. Yep. Examples are the dry clump of bamboo, or some animal poo. It wasn't animal poo, it was my poo. Are you saying I'm an animal? No, that okay, if you don't know this story, this is one of my classics. Absolutely gross. Yeah, I say, oh no. But it's absolutely true. We're not, no exaggeration. I love it. I remember telling this in IMS Spirit Rock, and have people howling and crying with laughter because they never heard it before, this story, because there's a meditation center over in San Francisco. And it was when I was in my retreat center, you know, Jhana Grove in Perth. You know, I meditate as well when I teach. And I get some really nice meditations. And it's natural. After you get a really, really nice meditation, you're just so happy. Everything you see is absolutely beautiful. You know, the colours are rich. You know, it's not like washed out. And the smells, many people actually in meditation, they smell fragrant smells, like maybe sandalwood or some other incense. And it's not that the sandalwood is here, it's just their nose, their faculties get so powerful, they can smell these things. And they go out and you're walking barefoot and the earth is just so rich, it's like moving underneath you. You can feel the whole earth. It is so powerful with your mindfulness. Everything looks incredible. So this was happening to me. The only reason I got out of meditation was because, you know, I'm a human being, human body, I have to go to the toilet. So I went to the toilet, and that was to perform what in Australia we call a number two. You know a number two and a number one? Yeah, I think you do, yeah. Well, you soon find out what a number two is when I continue the story. My mistake, I should not have done this. So I'm very careful never to do this again. And if you have a good meditation, don't do this. Look in the bowl. Wow! in all my life, I've never, ever seen such a beautiful piece of shit like that. Honestly. Now, don't just think it's... people just look at these things and flush it down straight away. You know, it was like a sculpture, just the way those little balls, you know, all formed together into this long sausage shape. Now, look, appreciate it. Don't just assume that it's ugly. You know, it was... the shape and the contours were amazing. And the colours, it's not just one colour of brown. Check it out next time. It's many different shades of brown. And the way those colours interacted and just fed off each other, the darks, the lights, the intermediates, and just this whole, it's like a tapestry woven by some great artist. It was like something done by Michelangelo. It deserved to be on a Sistine Chapel wall, not in a toilet bar. It was amazing. And then I started getting into the fragrance. And it's rich. I mean, really rich and earthy and deep. You know, it smelt of life itself. You know, the raw material from which plants and flowers and trees and vegetables grow. The rich, earthy smell of poo. And I was really getting into it. I was looking at it and going, wow! Wow! Look at that! Smell that! And honestly, I was really getting into it. And the thought, I remember the thought coming up in my mind. I'm going to take this out and show it to my friends. It just out of compassion, so they could also appreciate the beauty and the fragrance. Maybe I can put it on the wall, you know, with a nice frame around it. But, and the only reason I didn't do that was because all my life as a monk, I've been trained in letting go. Even the beautiful things. It was a tough one, but, you know, with all that training you had, you could do it. Person, should I? No, I can't. Oh, come on, go on. You got, let go. No. This attachment, okay, fair enough, and I let it go. And the most beautiful turd in the world went out of my life forever. That was so sad. It's a gross story. But it's absolutely true. And if that can look beautiful, imagine when you go home and look at your mother. Or your granddad. Wow! 88 years of old. You are incredibly beautiful, Dad, granddad. Everything looks beautiful. So this is actually what happens. And it's not such a stupid story, because there was one of the disciples, and he's, I think, a professor of theoretical physics. He works on the Hadron Collider. And he was always interested in Buddhism. But he said, had one philosophical question which he could never really get his head around, and this story answered it. What is the nature of beauty? What is beauty? And actually, he said, well, you know, if through the power of the mind that a lump of shit can look beautiful, that gives him the answer. The beauty is not in the object. The beauty is what the mind adds to the object. And, you know, this is such an extreme example. He so often quotes it to his friends. To prove that beauty is what you add on to things. As with ugliness too. And often ugliness is just the negativity or low energy which you give to things. When you have high energy, a lot of stillness, everything in the whole world looks gorgeous. So that's the story of the lump of shit, which is beautiful. And it's true. Everything, animal poo, it wasn't animal poo, it was my own poo. I suppose I am an animal. Is this some sort of delusion? No, it's actually just the nature of life. I think it's more delusional. It's always just as delusional to think that poo is dirty and smelly. It's fragrant. You ask a blowfly. You ask the worm in the part of the dung, the cha-ching. Anyway, if you cut into the dry clump of bamboo or even the poo, one cannot see anything different to what it's seen outside. I do apologize if I've got this wrong. I'm grateful if you could explain all your teachings. I find very easy to understand, except this. Hopefully you understand now. It's just the mind is stilled and empowered. The things do look different because it's what you add on to things. They don't have that sort of nature, that qualities in and of itself. It also explains why when people fall in love, you know, when your son falls in love and you think, wow, she must be this really beautiful girl, and she comes home, you can do better than that, son. Oh, she's so beautiful. And oh, she's got such a wonderful face. Even the way she picks her nose is just so charming. And it's really true. Sometimes I can't understand why, you know, some of these guys, you know, because some of these guys are my monks. And, you know, they train them, and then they sort of leave for one reason or another, and a couple of years later they get married. Oh, you can get better than that. Oh, what are you talking about? She's gorgeous. She's beautiful. She's lovely. When you're in love, that's what happens. Just like, you know, when you've got deep meditation, even a lump of poo looks beautiful. So that's the same with your husband. Oh, he's so cute. 10 years down the track, you wake up. Okay, this is and a bit of inspiration, not really a question. For those of you who want to make really good karma, and it's very, very cheap, you don't have to give anything, it's very, very powerful, is at the end, do you need some good karma? If your meditation is not going so well, you're having difficulty in your life or with your relationships, your health's not very good, your business not very good, that means you haven't done much good karma. So it's a very easy way to make some good karma today. Take home some of the bags of rubbish from the BSV. Don't only take one bag each because, oh no, so many people come here. It's much more than a usual collection. So what they do, a wonderful idea, as you go home, you can take one of the bags of rubbish in your car, even if you come by the bus. You know, you put the bag of rubbish in the bus, it's allowed. Why not? Everyone's got, you know, some baggage in the bus or the tram. Put it in the tram and take it on the bus. Okay, you've got to do some exchanges, you know, here and there. But you don't have to worry, you know, if for some reason when you're changing the tram or the bus, you forget the bag of rubbish. It doesn't really matter. It's not like you forget your handbag or something. You don't have to go to the lost property and say, does anyone turn in a bag of rubbish from the BSV, please? So that's a very good thing to do. Those who wish to sign up as a member can go to the office during the break. So during the break, this is the office. Oh, this was the instructions, not a question, sorry. But anyway, it still holds. If you want to become a member of the greatest society in the world, next to the Buddhist Society of West Australia. This is elite, the elite membership of the Buddhist Society of Victoria. Hi Ajahn, during meditation I see a puddle of purple light like a raindrop when I become relaxed. This is like a distraction for me and sometimes cause headache. What should I do? Nothing. Stop doing stuff. So if it's there, fine, let it be. If it's not there, let it go. Okay, I'm going to give you a really good meditation instruction now. I've been using this a lot, teaching it to others. It's incredibly powerful. I think that for one range retreat I focused on this. It's an old story which many of you, I hope, will remember. Because it was in my first book. I've used it many, many times when I've given talks here, sitting here. It was a story of the Emperor's Three Rings. No, it's not the Emperor's Three Rings. The Emperor's Three Questions, sorry. The Three Questions. And the story, it's actually from Leo Tolstoy. In brief, when is the most important time? What is the most important thing to do? Who is the most important person? Emperor's Three Questions. And of course, the first one is the easy answer. When is the most important time? Now is any time you have. And every other time, even the next moment, what should I do next? There is no next. Next is not important. Now is the only time you ever have. Your future is being made right now. This moment is the only time you ever have to do anything for your future. Right now. If you are concerned about your future, if you want a happy, healthy, successful future, Stop thinking about the future. Look at the place where the future is made. And then you'll be successful. Now's the most important time. What is the most important thing to do? I think you all know that story I told about the doctor. Not to cure people, but to care for people. Not to change your husband, but to care for him. And then he changes. Not to cure your mother, but to care for her. Then they change by themselves. Caring is more important than curing. So the most important thing to do is to care. And who is the most important person? This was a really powerful one in this simile. It was the one right in front of you, whoever that happens to be. That was the story as I read it and as I repeated it in my first book, Opening the Door of Your Heart. But you have these stories and people think, that's like pop Buddhism. I want to go into the deep stuff. Give me seven enlightenment factors and dependent origination any day over that stupid stuff. But no. That is a very powerful teaching because now you apply it to meditation. When is the most important time? It's right now. It's not what should I do next to get something in the future. That's missing the point in meditation. You only have now. What do you do in meditation? Focus on the breath. Get rid of defilements. Stop the thoughts. No. Care. That's all. And what is the most important meditation object? The breath, light. What's the most important meditation object? The one right in front of your mind right now. That is the most important meditation object in the world. Whatever it is. And your job is not to do anything with it. Just to care for it. So that makes meditation so incredibly simple and powerful. So you're sitting there and you have a thought. If that thought is in your mind, in front of you right now, it is the most important thing in the world. Care for it. Don't try and get rid of it. In the moment. You find it vanishes pretty quickly. If you're tired, stop and talk. It's the most important thing in the world. It's right there in front of you. Care for it. Because what you're doing here, if it's the most important thing in the world, you are being mindful. If you're trying to get rid of it, you're not being mindful anymore. Your mindfulness is where you want to get to next. You're not looking where you are. You're looking where you want to be. So if this moment, whatever it is, don't judge it. Don't say, I shouldn't be thinking this. I should be thinking limiters, jhanas. No. Whatever's in front of your mind right now, the most important thing in the world for you. Care for it. And then you take off into incredible meditations. And all those questions. What happens when you see a purple light? If it's that right in front of you, it's the most important thing in the world. Care for it. That's all. Don't try and get rid of it. Don't try and hold it. Don't try and do anything except for caring. What is caring? Opening the door of your heart to this moment, no matter what it is. Opening the door of your heart to it, embracing it, letting it be. Letting go. And that becomes powerful meditation. I often like doing that. Sitting here, okay, what am I aware of right now? This is important. It's teaching me something. And a lot of time it teaches me that if I can accept this moment, give it importance, that's mindfulness, that's letting be, and that is the path to get into very, very powerful deep meditation. And then eventually when you get these powerful lights come up in the mind, whatever they come up, that's important. So should I get rid of it? Should I do anything? What are you talking about? I'm just caring for this. Open the door of my heart to this moment, no matter what it is, and giving everything importance. Just like I hope you understand when you come up to me, I'll try and give you importance. At the moment, the BSV is the most important Buddhist society in the world for me, because this is where I am. Next week, sorry, somebody else is. So that's a great way of living your life, and it's powerful meditation. Now the most important time, what the most important thing to do is to care. Not to change things. Not to change yourself. Self-improvement. That sucks. People are always trying to improve themselves. To what? Who's telling you what you should be? Psychologists? Doctors? That's why I'm saying, if you're sick, be sick. And if the doctor says, I'm trying to get you better, you've got no right to do that unless I ask you to. Stop trying to improve me, or get me better, or cure me. Care for me. Now that's a totally different ball game. I remember this person, he went into the bookshop. And on the counter there, he said, I'm looking for the self-help section. Can you please point out where the self-help books are? And the attendant said, sir, if I told you, it would defeat the purpose. That's an old joke, but I like that one. So that's important. Now the most important time. Whatever's in front of your mind right now, whatever you're aware of, is the most important object. Just care for it. That's all you need to do to get way, way, way down the track. Is it important to live the Dharma? This is more difficult than sitting on the cushion and meditating. The world is full of people who want to have material comfort and become bigger people, like me. I'm a big monk. Somebody was asking me, and I was doing a little function in Perth, the United Nations Day of FACEAC in West Australia. You did one here in Victoria. And they asked me to turn around to me and said, are you going to be around next week? And I said, I'm around every day. So that's quite witty. Ajahn Bhab is always around. I'm a round monk. Anyway. So, one to have become bigger people, career-wise, etc. As lay people, we confront these people all the time. Some are cruel and jealous. How does one cope with this peacefully? This is a challenge. Care for them. Don't try and change them. Can you do that? Care for them. Now, what would the world be without, say, Donald Trump? He's caused so much entertainment over the last few months. So many jokes. A Tricycle magazine in the United States did a picture of him. They photoshopped him, obviously, as a Buddhist monk. He had Donald Trump's head and the robes, Theravada monks, with all this sort of bowl and the arms bowl and everything in front, big Buddha statue behind him. They said, Donald Trump has left the presidential race and become a monk. It's really funny. But he's caused a lot of humour, so thank you, Donald, for entertaining us. So sometimes, what would the world be without the idiots? I'm recognisable, so thank you, all you megalomaniac people. We learn so much of this. Because that's what I was taught by Ajahn Chah. Whenever you got bitten by mosquitoes, he said, call them Ajahn, your teacher, your guru, your master, Master Mosquito. Master Trump, Ajahn Donald. He's going to teach us so much. So that way, Ajahn wife. Really irritating sometimes, worse than mosquito. But you learn so much from her. So this is just changing your attitude. So, and that's called living the Dhamma. Ajahn, I understand the continuity of consciousness in reincarnation. Please explain the biology of reincarnation. You see special birthmarks, birth defects, etc. Yeah, that's weird. You've seen that. Many people, they have scars or birthmarks. I don't know if you heard this story, but because one of our members is really into past life regression, where they hypnotize someone, you get into your past lives. And he was telling me that one of his friends, he goes to all these conferences, gets all these amazing stories, really interesting stories. They were regressing a brother and sister. And the sister had a birthmark around her throat, a line. And under hypnosis, she claimed to remember a past life in San Francisco. Must have been quite a while ago. And she was finished work. She was in the newspaper industry. Finished work, and as she was walking home, this guy jumped out from behind a stone column and cut her throat. And that's where she got the birthmark from. And but the most interesting part of that was after finishing regressing her, he regressed her brother, who also had some psychological problems. And he said in his past life he was a very bad man. And the worst thing he ever did was he was behind a stone column in San Francisco, jumped out and slit the throat of a girl. That's freaky, isn't it? How karma works. You know, he slit his present sister's throat in a previous life. And somehow or other, the karma they had together, he had to be her brother in this life. Somehow to make amends, I don't know what. But they get born together. So if you have fights with your siblings, maybe you know where that came from. That's a freaky story, but that happens. So, you know, sometimes even where does the birthmark come from? Again, remember the power of the mind. So under hypnosis, you know, you think it's going to be a burn mark, and you create sort of a burn, a physical injury to your trauma, to your skin. So if you can do that sort of with hypnosis, you can imagine just what you can be doing in your mother's womb, you know, when you actually, your body is developing. Your mind can actually create that. And that is your birthmark. Or one of the other ones, okay, lots of questions here. But you know, you like stories, you know, and I like telling these stories. Great ones. Those of you, and if you have a friend, you know, maybe a daughter or someone has a stillbirth, and it's really devastating for women sometimes. You know, they've gone all the 9 months of pregnancy, all the great tests and everything. No, really excited, everything is ready in the home, all your relations are just waiting for the news, and it comes out, and it's dead when it comes out. And that happened to some of my disciples in Perth, the Thai couple. And, you know, they'd had an ultrasound 5 days before the birth, everything totally normal, but the kid, you know, the fetus or whatever, it had actually turned around and choked itself on the cord, strangled, you know, stopped the blood supply, so it was stillborn. But nevertheless, they named it Charlie, and you know, just perfectly formed little being, and they took a photograph of it, because they wanted me in the photograph as well, with family muck, and had a little Charlie, leant up, me next to him and the family on either side. He made it into the family album, Charlie. But what I never saw at the time, they only told me afterwards, when I wasn't watching, no one was watching, they got a ballpoint pen and drew a line on their dead baby's heel. Just a line on the heel. Because it's an old Thai tradition. If the baby's going to come back, it's going to have that as a birthmark. And of course, the reason I tell the story is because she's a very healthy woman. She got pregnant again pretty soon. And she gave birth this time to a daughter with that as a birthmark. Same foot, same heel. It's got a line on it. Birthmarks. So, come back again. And of course, it's great because I was watching her grow up. It was a her this time, and Annie, her name was. It was Charlie before. And you know that this was, you know they call them tomboys? She was a tomboy. She liked hanging out with the boys, not with the girls. And she never liked wearing dresses. She was wearing sort of boys' clothes and stuff when she was young. And just really rough, you know, like tough. And you understand why she was like that, because, you know, we knew that she was Charlie before. And this time she got born as Anne. So that's where some of these birthmarks come from. You can make those birthmarks. Even if you want to mess around, you know, your grandma dies or something. And if you really, you know, and you got sort of, you know, that you are, you know, that sort of age, you're looking to have a child or something, give it a go. Put a mark on, because the heel apparently, they're not supposed to have birthmarks on heels. Put a, you know, your mark, an X or something, or an O, or a square box, or a diamond, or something. Not to, don't sign your name with it. Because you don't get birthmarks that complicated. Give them a chance. So just put a mark there somewhere, you know, on a part of the body, and see what happens. You know, sometimes it works, and it's, imagine that. That will actually almost convince you that, you know, this is your mum come back again into your life. Why not? Sorry?
Permanent
mark. Okay, anything will do. Okay. One of the little questions during the interview interval I wanted to focus on, and that was that if you do make this moment really important, now how can you not get attached and involved in it? And it's a difficult question, but the best simile I've ever come across was when I was in an airport once transiting. I was walking through the places where people were sitting down waiting for the flight to take off. And there's a huge TV there, and they were showing the soccer. And as they were showing the soccer, there's these men watching, and they were shouting, "Offside! Shoot! Shoot! Goal!" And they were shouting. And this was actually in Singapore, in Changi Airport. And the match was actually in Anfield, in England. And I thought, why on earth are you shouting for? It doesn't matter how loud you shout, they can't hear you in England. And it's also a replay anyway, it's already happened. But why is it we say, shout, shout, offside, score? Why is it we actually do that? You can see men do that. You know, even probably at home here, there's some football match on. And it's at home, and they're shouting at the screen. And they can't hear it in the match. It's too far away. And it's the same also, that's men, women. You're watching a movie, and you see they break up. And you get so sad and cry, you get the tissues out. What are you doing that for? It's only a movie. Do you see how we can get involved in things? We can get so involved. I remember as a student going to see, actually other people have seen this, so amazing, there's this really stupid horror movie called Tarantula. No, 45 years ago, you know, with your mates, just going out for an evening at the movies. And Tarantula just was an ordinary tarantula, but was involved in some nuclear accident. And this is the point in those days, okay, just really stupid. And it had mutated into this huge monster. And was like eating people and attacking them. But one thing I did notice, and it's an interesting thing, I think it's still the same. People actually tell me it's the same these days. If there's a monster like that, or like some vampire or zombie or something, they, in the movies, they only attack the beautiful young women. So if you're old, ugly and fat, you are safe from monsters. They don't want anything to do with you. It's only the beautiful hot ones they want. But anyway, there was Tarantula after this beautiful young woman. And someone in the audience, you know, in the movie theatre, they shouted out, "Look out behind you, Tarantula!" They shouted it out, and we all just burst out laughing. You can't hear you, it's a movie. But why do people do that? Why do people cry, you know, on a movie, on the sad parts? Why do they get excited, you know, in the really exciting parts of a movie? And why do they shout at the football or the cricket match? They hit the ball up in the air. "Catch it, catch it!" You hear your husband saying. They can't hear you. But why do you actually do that? Because you get involved. You get entangled in the action. I used to watch soccer, and I realized too that when I was watching soccer, you know, as a young man on the TV, you actually got sucked in. I actually believed, you know, psychologically, I was at the ground. So I could actually shout and somehow influence the match. When you're watching the movie, you actually perceive yourself inside the movie set. So you could actually warn the heroine that Tarantula was about to bite you with her fangs. You really get drawn into the action. And that type of entanglement is the same thing which happens in meditation. We have thoughts or fantasies or fears. Really, that world of thoughts is just as real as Hollywood movies. You make it up. It's 99% fantasy. Yeah, you tie it to the real world, but it's not really that real at all. But you get drawn into it, entangled into that world of what you think is reality. It's no more real than what they call reality TV. It's fake, it's made up. So what we actually learn how to do is, if you want to watch a movie in a different way, to stand back and always remember throughout the whole movie, always be mindful, you're sitting in your lounge chair at home and this is all happening on a screen. It's not real. If someone gets killed during the movie, you will find in the next showing that they have been reincarnated. They're alive again. And if you're watching a football match, you realize, look, there's no way that I can shout and influence. It's already happened. It's a repeat of what happened earlier today or yesterday. When you remember those things, you find you don't get so involved in it. You're not entangled anymore. You put distance between you and what you're watching. And I found that is the best way to disentangle yourself with the thoughts, the ideas, the emotions, even feelings in the body. Yeah, you're feeling grief. But the grief is out there, and you are looking at it from a distance, like in the seat of a movie theater, and all that grief of your life is being played out like a movie on a screen, and you're not part of that movie. You're a separated observer. And it's the same anything else which is happening, thoughts, ideas, tiredness or whatever, that you are the tiredness, as if you're watching at a distance. You're not entangled, you're not involved. And when you're not entangled and involved in the movie, you don't get upset, you know, when the hero gets killed. You don't reach for the tissues anymore. No suffering. And when somebody else, your opposite team, scores a 6 and Sri Lanka gets booted out of the World Cup, you don't really get depressed anymore, because it's just cricket match, that's all. You don't get entangled. So that way of disentangling yourself, by putting distance between yourself and what you're observing, and realize what you're observing is not the observed, not the observer, is a different set. And that means you can actually let go, and it means you don't get so entangled, which means that the movie, the cricket match, is not so important anymore, which means you can just turn it off. Movies are all the same, the movies. But why? I think at one, we had a movie club in our college when I was at university, and some of the people there, they were just really smart and witty, and they had the list of movies for that term, and this fellow wrote on the little paper the list of movies: Sex and Violence in South Africa, it was like Zulu, Sex and Violence in Los Angeles, it was Dirty Harry or something, Sex and Violence in London, it was Jack the Ripper or something. And what they said, it was just all the movies were just sex and violence, just with, you know, different characters in different cities and different times. You know, Star Wars, Sex and Violence in Space. In the end, that's all they are. So what does that actually say? All the movies are the same plot, just about. And just they're just variations of the same theme. Boy meets girl. And then something happens. They get involved in some intergalactic power struggle. And in the end, you know, the girl and boy meet together again. And they save the world. And the world always gets saved. I don't know why that happens. Even just all these superpowers. They've got all these supermen now. Well, they've got this. I've seen this in the adverts. They've got Superman, X-Man, Spider-Man, Batman, Iron Man, Ant-Man. Yeah, I've got Spider-Man already. What about Spider-Woman and Ant-Woman? So Wonder Woman, what about Worm Woman? They got all this, and I'm not sure if I've never seen these movies. Have you seen the movies? All the same, that they have to, some demonic forces about to destroy the world, and they almost get there. They almost destroy the world, but the last minute, Spider-Man comes and does his stuff and saves the whole world. You don't need to see the movie. You don't know the plot, how it's going to end. So anyway, that's like the movies inside your head. So you disentangle them. When you disentangle them, it means you have much more peace. But do you want to get disentangled? That's the point. So sometimes we get so bored, we have nothing else. That's why we get entangled in the fantasies and dreams of life. But when we actually disentangle for a while, we find the real world, I mean the real peace, is so much more delightful than all this other stuff. Anyway, number one, how do we get rid of loneliness? Oh, I just love to be alone. I just have so much work to do, so many people. You know, you have a tea break. Do I have a tea break? My tea is half drunk there because everyone's in front of me and asking this question and that question, saying hello and just... And then after it's finished, more people here and they follow me to the room and they ask these questions and then there's emails to answer and, oh, I'm never alone. I became a monk to be alone. Now look at me. Thousands of people follow me wherever I go. So that's not the point. The point is if you're by yourself or you're with other people, you're happy. So you don't fight the world. So if you are single and you haven't got a partner to share your life with, you are so lucky. I'm so jealous of you. But you have what they call single person suffering. It's a certain type of suffering when you're by yourself, you go home at night and it's just you. But wait till you get a partner. Now you find out what real suffering is. Why are you laughing? Because it's true, isn't it? When you've got a partner, you've got married people suffering. There's all suffering in every way. So just be happy with the suffering you have. If it's you're alone, then enjoy aloneness. It's got so many benefits. There's no one to argue with you. You can watch whatever channel on the TV you like. You can eat what you like. No one's actually telling you, that's bad for you, this is good for you, this is healthy. It's all crikey. Driving mad. So, imagine the freedom of being by yourself alone. Or the wise people. Don't get married. Get a dog. A dog is so much better than a husband or a wife. They never nag you. And they're always happy to see you. Your wife and Abby, you're late, darling. The dog always wags its tail when you come home. And they're much easier to look after than a wife. Wives are so expensive. They are. But this man, you know, he gave his wife a diamond necklace. A really expensive one. Worth a fortune. He gave his wife... Imagine that, getting from your husband a really expensive diamond necklace. And she never spoke to him afterwards for 6 months. And his friends said, that's really ungrateful. You spent all this money buying your wife a diamond necklace and she didn't speak to you for 6 months afterwards. Yes, said the husband, that was the deal. And you laugh because there's some truth behind that. You think it may be worth it. You may have got an idea there to get a piece of quiet in your life. So that's how to get rid of loneliness. If you're by yourself, that's fine. But you don't need to be lonely, because when you are no one else there, you are always there. And if you are your best friend, you've got a good relationship with yourself, you never feel lonely. Yes, you're alone, but never lonely. Dear Bhante, Samadhi is the first step of the Eightfold Path. Could you please explain how understanding the Four Noble Truths becomes essential towards achieving the main goal? Ah, oh, like one thing is like the Four Noble Truths that life sucks. It's Four Noble Truths. It's true. So what do you better be reborn for? And we always think, it's not that life sucks, it's that we do it wrong. And if we can come to a place like this and become wise, then life doesn't suck anymore. We can actually fix it up, life. If we become wise and kind, then life will be beautiful and wonderful, and the whole world can live at peace. You know, and you know, John Lennon's Imagine, no religion, everyone be peace and harmony. Yeah, sure. Life sucks. Which means this world, this is how it is. It will always be this way. Yeah, we try to make it better, but unfortunately there'll still be crazy people, selfish people, rich people, poor people. Try to make it better, but this is the nature of our world. And the only thing to do is to get out. This world is a prison, a jail, and it's got five walls. Big walls. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching. The five walls of your prison. And what do most people do? Well, prison's not a bad place. I'll just study hard in prison school, get a nice degree, and I can qualify as an engineer in prison. And that means I get a much better cell. And even better food. So some people, you know, here in Melbourne prison, have a nice big house with so many rooms in it. And they've got, you know, they've saved up their prison credits called superannuation. And they even find another nice prisoner to marry and share life and have little baby prisoners. If they don't have baby prisoners, have little dogs in their cell with them. Two nice little dogs. And they try and make their prison cell, their house and their life as happy as possible. They even have little Buddhist societies in prison. So you can come, you know, every year when I come along into prison and teach you, and you get really inspired. And you think prison is a wonderful place. You know, if you can just make it a little bit better, you spend all your time trying to make yourself a happier place. Until one day you realize, hang on, it doesn't matter how hard I work, what I do, how smart, clever, rich I am, this is prison. And you read a book called Sutras by the Buddha, you say, actually, there's a way out of prison. There's a tunnel called the Eightfold Tunnel. And that Eightfold Tunnel leads under the walls, under, outside the five senses, out into freedom, nirvana. And that's the Eightfold Path, tunneling under the walls of the five senses till you leave them behind. Unfortunately, in prison, there's this guard, really sadistic, who never leaves you alone, always makes you do something, always keeps you restless. And that prison guard's got a name. He's called Will. Will the prison guard. You know what Will also means, don't you? Your intentions, your will, your doer. And that Will never leaves you alone. Meditation time, you sit down, you're always doing something. Will just will not let you be peaceful. But when you start climbing or crawling through the Eightfold Tunnel, the Will can't follow you in there. If Will comes with you into the Eightfold Tunnel, you do stuff. You can't get very far. And so you go through this Eightfold Tunnel and you get the right view. But actually, this is much more peaceful and calmer when you start practicing. And you soon see the light at the end of the tunnel. That's called streamlining. And when you see the light at the end of the tunnel, that really encourages you to really get through that tunnel. But you've got to be, you know, have the right thought, right intention. If you get the wrong intention or wrong view, you take the wrong forks in the Eightfold Tunnel and you come to dead ends. If you've got the right view and the right intentions, you go straight to the end of the tunnel, But if you've done any bad karma, you've got bad speech, bad action, bad livelihood, you find that, you know, because of all of that, you're too fat to fit through the tunnel. You get stuck halfway because of your indulgences of bad stuff. But if you keep... I'm making this up as I go along. It's not bad. If you've got the right speech, action, livelihood, you can go right through. Obviously, it takes a lot of work to crawl through that tunnel. That's the right effort. And you have to be really alert with mindfulness, because if you make any noise as you're escaping, the prison guard will catch you and drag you back into the cell. And you have to be just so focused with samadhi. And that's the way you get out of the tunnel into nirvana. You escape from jail. So that's samadhiti, the Eightfold Path. How do I make my mind free from a boyfriend who told me that I am not good to be a mother of his children and said I am a dumb woman? You are so lucky to be free of incredibly conceited, arrogant idiot of a man like that. He makes it sort of embarrassment to our male gender, a guy like that. You are lucky to be free. We should have got free of him much easier than that. If I was you, I'd never be a mother of a boy's children like that. Wow, that's a really terrible guy. So you're so lucky to be free. Don't let boys press your buttons and tell you're good enough or you're bad enough. It's up to you to know whether you're good enough or bad enough, and everybody is good enough. At the university, that's why I told the story of the trees, because that's one of the biggest problems in a modern world. People never think they're good enough. I'm not good enough, monk. I should tell better jokes. I should do. Oh, yes, you're a terrible person. You just don't appreciate humour. Okay, so anyway, people keep telling you not good enough. So, answer to that problem, I'll probably tell this story again, because this is a great story. I'll probably tell this tonight, it's an amazing story. Go and find the most beautiful tree in the forest, the perfect tree, in the forest. One which is dead straight, all the branches equally spaced, only green leaves, no yellow leaves, no brown leaves, no leaves eaten by the bugs. Beautiful green leaves, branches equally spaced, nice and straight, not bent, and no damage to the bark. Those trees do not exist. Every tree is damaged. Look at the bark. Every tree is bent. Every tree has yellow leaves, brown leaves, and leaves eaten by the bugs. It's nature. And in fact, the most beautiful trees in the forest are the ones which are the most bent. They've got character. If they've got damage to the bark, it gives them this incredible beauty. So, I'll tell that to people. If you believe somehow or another you're not good enough, there's something wrong with you, that you're damaged goods, go into a forest and realize that you belong. You belong as one of these incredible trees in the forest called humanity. Human beings. And actually, the more damaged you are, the more beautiful you become. That's what happens with trees. My favorite tree is the one which is the most bent. So if you've really got a bent and crooked husband, he's so gorgeous. That's what this idea of being good enough. We always want to be straight trees, improve ourselves. And why do we want other people to think of us? No, whoever you are, however bent, crooked, damaged, this broken off, that broken off, that is who you are. You belong. Welcome. And actually, you're really gorgeous and beautiful. If you were perfect, you just have no character at all. It wouldn't be a person. So that's why I celebrate defects and faults. Celebrate them. They make life beautiful. So for goodness sake, stop trying to improve yourself. Otherwise you get rid of all your beauty and charm. If my jokes did get any better, it wouldn't be the same Ajahn Brahm. It would be something missing when I come to Melbourne. Same if you were just any different than you are, you know, known you for such a long time. You know, they wouldn't recognize you at all. It wouldn't be the same. Anyway, I come here every year, get motivated after this retreat, go home, practice for a few days, and completely drop out of practice until this time next year. That's not bad. At least you come here once a year, that's something. How can I break this cycle? I have no problems in meditating with interest for even an hour once I start, but I find myself involved in so many other things, including voluntary social work and getting into debates on Facebook. Oh, that's endless, debates on Facebook. Look, you should know this, that you can't convince anybody that they're wrong. You know, I know these lawyers that get married, really good lawyers. They can convince a jury and a judge that somebody who really is a criminal, who's actually, you know, murdered people, stolen, they can get them off the charges. They can argue so well to convince a jury that someone who's guilty is actually innocent. Amazing lawyers. But that lawyer tries to convince his wife that she's wrong. No way. I'm not talking about. It's a waste of time arguing with a wife or a husband or on Facebook. You are wasting time. No way you can get them to admit they're wrong. No way they can get you to admit you're wrong. So just forget about debates. They're a total waste of time. So don't argue. Just go and do what you want to do and just forget about what other people say about you. So, what are the motivating factors that can help one to start and continue a daily practice of meditation? What can help prioritize life goals? I want Nibbana most. I can become a monk, a nun. But you're probably married and stuff. What do you do that for? Get married? Put yourself in jail for 20, 30 years? You must have done some terrible crime to get married. I'm a monk, so don't ask me to get romantic. Okay, anyway. Daily practice. Oh, marriage. They say that marriage is like a pack of playing cards. Have I told you this one before? Marriage is like a pack of playing cards. You start off with two hearts, and then you get a diamond. And you finish off with clubs and a spade. The rings of marriage. You know the three rings of marriage? What are the three rings of marriage? No. The three rings of marriage is offering, sharing, and care ring. I change it around every now and again. Oh, that's really nice. Just changing it around. You know, you're offering your life to something bigger than you. That's the first ring, offer ring. And you share your life together, everything together, all your assets together. It's share ring. And the most important, care ring. Nice feelings of marriage. Not the other ones which you know already. Okay, well, and how to actually start daily practice. One thing is make it easy. Have a place in your house where you can meditate very easily. A room in which you put just for meditation, a corner of a bedroom. So have the facilities easily available. So you don't need to find a quiet place. It's there for you. In the office. A place where you can meditate. It's there for you. So that, you know, if you really want to, you don't set things up, go there straight away. That helps. You can have, like, if I'm your teacher, if you really respect me, have my picture by your bedroom. You say, oh God, Ajahn Brahm's looking at me again, I better meditate.
there's a bit of guilt.
But also, just after a while you realize that meditation, you don't find time to meditate. Meditation allows you to find time for other things. As I said to someone earlier, that story, this man I know, he meditates 1 hour every day. 1 hour every day, except when he's busy. And when he's busy, he meditates 2 hours a day. Because he has to be efficient. He knows that meditation actually makes time. More efficiency, greater productivity. Not wasting time, getting tired, getting upset and angry and stressed. So that's why to meditate. Is it time a normal human being think more than 50,000 thoughts a day? I saw this on a website. It will be going to lesser and lesser when we do meditation. Saying 50,000 problems a day. Crikey, that must be torture. I call every thought like a lash. 50,000 lashes a day on your poor brain. That kills you. Because every thought, you know, sort of, actually does hurt, thinking. Having to think about things, it's much better just to be peaceful, relax and rest. Why not? You don't have to think. So stand up for your rights. Your right to be peaceful. I'm not going to think today. Can you do that? Have a thought-free day. Can you do it? Why not? Just you've got into bad habits of always having to think. And we assume that we can solve all of our problems through thinking. You should have figured it out by now. Thinking just creates more problems. Doesn't actually solve anything. Doesn't finish anything. But thought just proliferates onto more and more and more problems to be solved. Philosophers, can they find the meaning of the universe? No. Scientists, can they find the answer to how this universe works? No. Every time they, even in the Large Hadron Collider, when they said they found a Higgs boson, which I think they haven't, they had so many more problems. More questions arose than answers were found. Welcome to science. We never answer the question. We answer one question and two more pop up like Hydra's head in Greek philosophy. You cut off one head and two more pop up. That's called thinking. There's no end to it. Which is, the more you think, the more you've got to think about. It never, ever ends. But meditation, you stop the thoughts. You're silent. There you have all the answers. The hungry man wanted to light the fire to cook his rice. He had the wood, he had the pot, the water and the rice, but he didn't have a flame. So he went around the house looking for a flame, because it was night time. He used a candle to look for a flame. If he had only known what flame was, he'd have cooked his rice much more quickly. If he only knew what truth was, he wouldn't need to think so much.
What about this theory about if you don't use it, you lose it?
Oh, it's wonderful. If you don't use your thought, you're peaceful at last. You lose your thinking. You lose your suffering. It's wonderful. If you don't use your husband, you lose him. Great. No, they have this idea that keep your brain active, like do Sudoku puzzles, keep it exercised. Go and do philosophy classes when you're 78. It's like a lot of bunkum. And it's because if you don't do that, you'll get dementia. And actually, I probably actually prefer dementia than having a crazy mind thinking all over the place. Given the choice, I'd rather have just a peaceful mind. But, you know, dementia, at least you don't have to worry about what somebody said about you last week. Like you have to do all the time. So, I've got dementia, I forgot what the question was. I'm really interested. The research hasn't been done. Put it on evidence based. People who meditate, do they get dementia? And I actually would probably say, if you meditate properly, deeply, so you get a lot of stillness, you'll find you're actually preserving the brain because you're not using it. Just like, you know, if you don't overuse your credit card, you can actually last much longer. So it's not, if you don't use it, you lose it. If you use it, sometimes you lose it. Can you please advise me on how to progress from the nimitta stage to the jhanas? I often see nimittas where meditated, but currently that's as far as the practice goes. Kind regards. Be content with just getting to the lights. And don't want the jhanas. Then you'll make progress. But when you want something, you're stuck. The whole path is letting go of wanting, just being content. And the jhanas are just contentment upon contentment upon contentment, like putting more contentment coins in your piggy bank. Another contentment coin, and soon you get so much wealth of contentment. It builds up, and that's a beautiful deep meditations, and the nimittas, and the jhanas, and everything just builds up with your contentment credits. But as soon as you want something, you lose all of that credit you've been building up. So just be content, be happy there. Nimittas, beautiful lights. Wouldn't you want one of those? Oh, I've never seen any light, been meditating such a long time. Just see a tiny light, tiny one, little one, please. And these people have all these lights and they want something more. Really unfair. So, be content with what you have. And then things happen. People always assume that to get progress in meditation, you have to do something. That's what happens in life, but it works a totally different way in meditation. When you do nothing, you're content. Happy to be here. Don't want anything else in the whole world just to be here. Content. No wanting, no craving, even for good things. Not wanting anything at all. Being in this present moment. This is the most important moment right now. I don't want anything else. I'm just caring for this moment. That's what I'm doing. Don't want anything else. And my mind is not off in the future thinking about jhanas or enlightenment or so on or anything. Just happy being here. That's called contentment. Letting be. You have many moments like that and things start to happen. You don't do it. The path is, but no traveler on it is seen. Don't travel the path. Disappear. Da da da. Okay. Okay, last question. The other questions, I'm sorry you didn't have enough good time to get them answered because we need to do some meditation afterwards. Last question, we do some meditation until 4. I get hurt easily, especially when something happens from my closest ones. I think it has a negative impact on me. I feel emotional in all this situation. How to overcome this? Again, what I said the other day, you have a choice not to get hurt. Something happens to other people, that's par for the course. What do you expect in life? I get hurt, you get hurt. And so you listen to a person, like I have to do every day of my life as a monk. And like even this morning, this one of the meditators here, was it the father got hit by a truck and killed this morning? Yeah. Does that hurt you? Are you shocked? You have a choice not to be. Does getting shocked really help the situation? Just get, this is so terrible, it could be my father next time. Does that help? Of course it doesn't help, but that is our stupid way of behaving sometimes. Oh, that's so sad. That's so terrible. This happens in life. So, when something happens to your closest ones, you do have a choice. Actually, to use the Dhamma, not to react, doesn't really help at all. And when you don't get shocked and upset, you can actually be of much better assistance to people. Calm the situation down and be peaceful. And sometimes that's one of the biggest gifts you can do. So you have a choice in the training not to get hurt so easily. If you get hurt when somebody else gets hurt, that's two people hurting. You add to the suffering in the world. It doesn't help at all. So what I do when people come and tell me these things, I listen to them, be empathetic as much as I can. But as soon as they leave and they've told me the story and they leave away, I let it go. What Ajahn Chah taught me, you have to be a dustbin, a trash can. So you listen to all the rubbish and stuff, all the hurt from your family and friends. You've got to empathize. Take it in. But you have to be a trash can, a rubbish bin, with a hole in the bottom. So you don't keep anything. You listen to all the tales of woe and difficulties of people in life. And as soon as you've received it all, it goes right through and you keep nothing at all. Which means you're always empty for the next person to listen to. But you don't keep anything. You don't take anything away with you. To be the rubbish bin with the hole in the bottom. That's how Ajahn Chah taught me to be a counsellor. Then, what happens to other people, you can help, you can be kind, but you don't get hurt. Very good. Okay, taking care is letting go. So, how do you take care of your kids? Okay, let you go, off you go. If you want to go somewhere, that's fine by me. And I would be here for you. The door of my heart's really open to you no matter whatever happens to you. I don't control you. That's what my father said to me. That's where the opening door of his heart story comes from. He let me go. That's an incredible, powerful way of showing how much he cared for me. They are the same.
If somebody is telling me a kind of...
Yeah. Thing, how do you... So you listen to them, you care for them, you show empathy. When it's finished, you let it go. But you don't keep thinking about it and holding it and worrying about it and carrying the wound of that. It's not your wound. Otherwise, you carry the whole weight of the world's problems on your shoulders, because there's loads of problems like that. And you also, by not carrying it, you're showing them, yeah, you know, there's tragedies in life, there's much more to life than that. How big is my hand? So big I can't see anybody. All I can see is my hand. When you have a tragedy, that's what it's like. Yeah, it's real, but you haven't got the perspective. Put it where it belongs. Yeah, the father died, got hit by a truck. All we see is the death. What about the life? How long has that father lived? How many wonderful times have you had together? Don't allow the way a life ends to blind you to how the life has been lived. Remember that. Keep it in perspective. You think, wow, what a wonderful time we've had together. You've been my father for such a long time. Had such wonderful experiences together. Remember the life, not just the ending of it. And then you're at peace with these things. So that way, that is caring, by allowing another person to see another perspective.